All right, welcome everybody. It is Tuesday, June 23rd, 10:20. We're doing Chem 3 lecture. And today we're picking up where we left off. We left off last time in chapter 2.3. And in chapter 2.3, we were dealing with, as I'm looking over at my notes instead of the camera, and in chapter 2.3, we had just introduced the idea of isotopes, and we're starting to get to this concept of an average atomic mass for a group or family of isotopes. And rather than jump into that, because I said that was going to be a whole big ordeal, I told the story of the California condors and the lead bullets and the tracing of lead through atomic mass spectroscopy. And how we can tell where different metals come from, what region of the planet those metals had been mined from, simply by looking at their relative isotopic distributions, which is kind of a cool concept. So today is actually a fairly hefty lecture. We're going to go through a lot of material today, hopefully. And we're going to hit this idea of weighted averages and being able to calculate the average atomic mass. So today we're going to look at calculation of average atomic mass. So that's one component of what we'll do. That will finish out chapter 2.3. So we're still in chapter 2.3. And then from there, I'm looking to see if there's anything else. No, nope. Then we move into 2.4. 2.4 is kind of a fun chapter where we're looking at molecular structure. We're looking at atoms, molecules, empirical formulas, isomers. There is some material in chapter 4 that is important, but mainly these are representations. Of atoms and molecules, different representational forms that we'll talk about. But then we get into empirical formulas, and isomers. And the most important component, I think, within chapter 24 will be the empirical formulas, but then we get into the mole and molar masses. And this is really the mole, molar mass, and a type of calculation that is called stoichiometry. And these guys here are really the meat of chapter 24, where we will spend most of our time and actually have the most impact on the rest of the class. Because the introduction of the mole, a molar mass, and stoichiometry calculations is fundamental to all of chemistry and is utilized throughout the rest of the semester. In every sort of chemistry example or problem that we put forward, all sort of falls within or has some component within stoichiometry and the mole and molar mass calculations. So that is where we are going to put major emphasis, and we will get into that today, but we may spend one more day really solidifying those concepts and going over those concepts. So chapter 2.4 is really... the end of chapter 2.4 is really critically important. And the homework assignment, I put together a new homework assignment for you. The majority of that homework assignment falls within 2.4 and that last section in 2.4. So that's where to put emphasis. That's where to do your reading and really do the majority of your work is in that part of 2.4. Okay, so with that in mind, let's go forward and let's look at chapter 2.3 and this calculation of average atomic mass. And we'll start our lecture there. We'll work for about an hour. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll pick it up in chapter 24 and looking at these ideas. We'll do some, yeah, that's what we'll do. Okay. Starting off in 2.3 and average atomic mass. This concept gets us where we need to be to understand the periodic table and to understand the average mass that is represented of an element. But before I start and go through that, maybe what I want to do is I'm going to open up a periodic table for me, not for you guys just yet. We'll bring one online for you guys in a little bit. But what I want is to pull an element, and it's not giving me the periodic table tools. Periodic table, where'd it go? I've got too many windows open and I can't find. There we go. Okay, so what I want to look at is an element. Could have just done this off the top of my head. I didn't really need to do this. Carbon, this is element number 6, and 12.0114 that sits at the bottom of the table. The number at the top of the table is the atomic number. This is the number of protons. And the number at the bottom of the table, this is the atomic mass. And that atomic mass is a weighted average of the individual isotopic masses. And we're going to look at how we calculate that number. And the reason that we need to do that, I need to give you a reason for why we need to calculate an average number like that. And so my my analogy and what I bring together to sort of introduce this is that you're working in a marble factory. Sort of a funny way to start this off. Not really where you wanted to be working, but somebody's got to work in a marble factory. You're working in a marble factory, and in this factory, your job is to fill a bag of marbles such that we get 100 marbles into each bag. And so we want to get 100 marbles into each bag. And the interesting part is that the marbles are not all the same. So what we have is we have a series of blue marbles and we have a series of red marbles. And the red ones, most of the marbles are the red ones. And then some of them are blue. But the marbles have different masses. And the question is, how are you going to get the marbles into the bag? And you get paid by how efficient you are and how fast you are at filling the bag. So there's some reason to fill the bag fast. And one of these marbles, the red one, weighs 5.36 grams. And the blue ones weigh 4.32 grams. And I'm making this up as I go, but that's okay. This works out great. And the percentages are somewhere in the neighborhood of 86.3% are red. And of the blue ones, we find that these occur in 13.7%. And I think that that comes out, if I did that right, 86.3 plus 13.7 should be 100%. And I'm right on. And the question is, if you want to fill the bag and you want to fill it the fastest, the best way to do it is by weight. So how much is a bag of 100 marbles going to weigh if this is the mixture of marbles? Essentially what we're saying is, or asking, is what if we take these marbles and we combine them to make an average marble? And that average marble is going to be 86%. 86.3% is going to weigh 5.36 grams. And the remaining 13.7% is going to weigh 4.32 grams. And what is this average marble weigh? And the way that we do that is by what's called a weighted average. So a weighted average is where we use the percentage and we multiply it by the mass in order to get that component of mass. So as we go through and do this, what we're going to find, and we'll take this marble and we'll copy this and put it down here. So we're going to do a weighted average. The way the weighted average works is we take the mass of the red marble and we multiply it by its percent, 0.863 times 5.36 grams. This is going to give me the mass of that part of the marble multiplying its percent times the mass as a decimal form for the percentage. So we're going to get 0.836 times 5.36. This is going to be 4.48096 grams.
So is that like the percent of occurrence times the mass of the thing?
It is. Okay. It is the relative abundance times the mass. So that's what we say is it's really the relative abundance in decimal form.
Okay.
And we're going to do the same for the blue. So for the blue, what we do is we take and we multiply 0.137 multiplied by its mass of 4.32 grams, and we'll get its percentage, 0.137 multiplied by 4.32. This is 0.59184. And then these get added together to produce my average marble. So as I add those together, plus 4.48096, we get an average marble weighs 5.0728 grams. And we should talk about sig figs. All of these quantities are measured quantities. So as we're going through and we're looking at sig figs, the percentages have 3 sig figs in each of the percentages. The masses have 3 sig hundredths position and do my rounding at the hundredths position. So like all the other problems that we've done, I'm not rounding until the very end. I'm tracking my sig figs through the multiplication, but then using that through the addition and rounding in the proper place such that I get a value that is 5.07 grams for an average marble. And that's what an average marble weighs, 5.07 grams. So now if I want to put 100 marbles into a bag, 100 marbles times the average weight that for every one average marble, it weighs 5.07 grams, then what I get is I get, on average, I need to get a 507 grams into each bag.
Jason?
Yeah.
I calculated, or I put on my calculator the 0.863 times 5.36, and I got a different number.
Yes, you did. And I see what I did. I dyslexically transposed two numbers in my calculator. Let me fix it. 0.863 times 5.36. There's an easier way to fix this, but we might as well do it the right way. The easier way was for me to change the original number so that all my numbers stay the same, but then that messes up all you guys. This is 4.62. 5, 6, 8 which changes everything. I love it when that happens. Such a wonderful feeling. Plus 0.59184. So this becomes an average mass of 5.21752. Maybe there's something to having worked out examples ahead of time so that I don't do this. And that is 5.22 grams. And that changes this number. That is 5.22 grams. And then on average, I need to weigh out 522 grams. And now we're in better shape. Thank you. I didn't look up to see who actually got that for me, but Vanessa and Nathan, you guys were all on top of it. You guys are following along with your calculators. Super. Thank you for doing that.
No problem. I'm a little confused about why you rounded it that way.
I rounded it that way because when I look at 3 sig figs and I count out 3 sig figs, mm-hmm. I do 1, 2, and 3. So mm-hmm. I'm out at the thousands position. On the red numbers, it is 1, 2, and 3 at the hundredths. And so I round at the hundredths position.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. So what I need to do then is, on average, the meaning of this, on average, if I weigh out 522 grams of marbles, then each bag will have approximately 100 marbles. Okay, quick story about this. We went to the fair one time for our school, for our kids' school when our kids were little, and they had a Costco-sized package of gumballs, one of those ginormous square containers of gumballs, transparent so you could see all the gumballs in it. And the gumballs had all different colors. And it was guess how many gumballs are in the thing, and you get the package of gumballs, right? And they had blocked out on the label where it said how many gumballs were in the package so that you couldn't see, you had to sort of estimate. But what they didn't block out, interestingly, was all the caloric information that is mandatory to print onto the package. And on each one of those packages, they had a serving size of one gumball and a number of calories, and then the total number of calories that were in the thing. And you could go through and you could use it as a weighted average to calculate out how many gumballs were actually in the package, just doing it by a weighted average. And so my two daughters and I sat down with a piece of paper and we calculated out using a weighted average how many gumballs were in the package. And then we wrote that down as our guess. And you know who went home with the gumballs? We did. Yeah, my wife was ready to kill me. She was not very happy with me, but it worked. So weighted averages. A weighted average is a way of taking isotopes that have different masses and calculating out their weighted average such that we can then use weight to figure out how many different or how many atoms we have in any grouping. That's what we use these weighted averages for. So now what we can do is we can use an isotopic distribution, and I suggest that maybe what we do is we use oxygen. Let's see if I can get oxygen to come up with its three relative isotopes. So let's do this example for oxygen. Oxygen comes in three different isotopes. There is oxygen 16, oxygen 17, and oxygen 18. For these different isotopes, I should spread them out a little bit. What we're going to do is we're going to look at their mass and their relative distribution. So the percent for each one of these, oxygen 16 is 99.762%. Oxygen 17 is 0.0380%. And oxygen 18, 0.200%. And their mass, in terms of AMUs, for the first one is 15. I'm going to round these off so I don't use all the sig figs that are here. Let's do it, 15.995 AMUs. Oxygen 17 weighs 16.999 AMUs. And oxygen 18 weighs 17.999 AMUs for that one. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use those values to calculate out what an average oxygen weighs.
Quick question. What is the relative abundance in relationship to?
It's in relationship to what percentage we find these isotopes in nature. So when we take a sample of air and we measure the oxygen and the relative distribution of the isotopes in that oxygen, what we find is that we find that most of them are oxygen 16. Some of them, very few, are oxygen 17 and a little bit more oxygen 18. But these are just the measured amounts in which we naturally find them.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Okay.
So is now that how we should call those numbers up there? Like those numbers are the
percentage? These are the mass. Oh, the percentages? Yeah. This percentage is the relative natural abundance.
It's like the frequency.
Yeah, like the frequency.
Cool.
It's the frequency with which we find that element. That's a good way to put it. So it's called the relative natural abundance, and it's a percentage. It's based on a percentage, and the percentages should all add up to 100. And then you're dealing with here the mass of the isotope in AMUs, in atomic mass units.
And will you remind me why those numbers are not rounded?
Why those numbers are not round? That is an excellent question. Those numbers we could think of as being rounded, but remember that when we looked at a proton, that a proton with a positive charge was approximately 1 AMU.
Yeah.
But not exactly 1 AMU. So the exact number for a proton was back here someplace. And I'll get it. There we go. 1.0073. And the neutron was approximately 1 AMU, but it was 1.0087 AMUs. And so the values that we're seeing for each individual isotope are not exact, but have a decimal value to them.
Okay, I remember that.
Okay. So as we go through and we do the weighted average, what we're going to do is we're going to take the percentage for oxygen 16 and we're going to do it as its decimal percentage. We could think of it as writing it over 100 and using it as a percent over 100. That's another way in which we typically do these. So we could say that this is 99.762 divided by 100. That's the percentage multiplied by its mass of 15.995 AMUs. And basically what that's saying is out of every 100 oxygens, 99.762 of them will be oxygen 16. And this is the AMUs for oxygen 16. And so that is giving me the contribution for the oxygen 16, essentially. And so the way that I wrote that before was just to express it as decimal form. I think this one sort of shows it written as a conversion factor a little bit more. And so we could write it either way. I'm going to write it this way this time, I think.
Could you say that first part again?
Yes. Let me express it both ways.
Thank you.
The one way that I could express this is to say that this is 0.99762 times 15.995 AMUs. And this is the percent, the relative abundance, times the mass for each individual isotope. And it is the percent expressed in decimal form. Another way to express that is to use it as a conversion factor to say that for oxygen 16, if I have 15.995 AMUs for an oxygen 16, and I multiply that and I say for every 100 oxygen atoms, I get 99.762 oxygen 16s. What this does is it's giving me the fraction of the total number of oxygens that are oxygen 16. And so I'm multiplying the mass by the fraction of the oxygens that are oxygen 16. And it is essentially the same thing. 0.99762, it's not essentially, it is the same thing, times 15.995. This equals 15.9569319 AMUs, which is the contribution from oxygen 16. And that is the same calculation that I just did here.
99.762% of O16 weighs that much, or it has that much mass.
I'm saying that if I had 100 atoms, that out of those 100 atoms, 99.762 would be oxygen 16s. And they would contribute that much mass to the 100 atoms.
Okay, got that.
That's a way of saying that.
Each individual oxygen 16 atom was 15.995 AMUs, right?
That is true. But when I take 99.762 of them and then divide that by 100 to make it a fraction of a single atom, essentially what we're saying is that we're calculating, if I take a sphere, I've got 99, this piece here, I've got 99.762%, which is O16. This little piece up here, this is going to be my 0.200%, which is going to be O18. And this last little tiny percent that is up here is going to be my 0.
Oh, and you're saying how much each one it contributes to the weight of the entire like atom, like this combined.
Yes.
Atom.
Yes.
Sorry, it was just a weird way of it. Yeah, I understand. Okay, cool.
That's exactly right. That we're looking at how much each one of these contributes to an average atom. That's what we're trying to figure out, is figure out how much that average atom weighs. And so we can take each one of these contributions, 380%, and this is oxygen 17 for that piece. And so, yes, that is exactly what we're doing, is we're averaging out each one of these contributions to how much that individual component is adding to an average oxygen atom. So we're finding out how much this little piece weighs, the blue piece first. And that piece we find weighs 15.956939, and then we have to do the sig figs for that. So if we leave this image here and I take this piece, and we'll copy it. We'll leave the image here. We'll paste this down here. And we do sig figs as we track this. So this is 5 sig figs. This is 5 sig figs. So we're going to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's my last sig fig there that I'm tracking in the thousandths position. I'm going to do the contribution now for oxygen 17, which is going to be my, got to go back to the table. This is why I had the table down there before. 16.999 AMUs for an oxygen 17 times for every 100 oxygen atoms, I get 0.0380 oxygens. So that's AMUs. That's what's missing in there. This should be AMUs for an oxygen 16. This is AMUs for an oxygen 17. We'll get that contribution. 16.999 times 0.0380 divided by 100. That comes out to 0.0064596.62 AMUs, and that is going to have, based on the values that I'm using, 5 and 3. So I get to keep 3. 1, 2, 3. That's my last sig fig there in that position. And we've got one more to go. So we do oxygen 18. And oxygen 18 was 17.999 AMUs. For an oxygen 18 times for every 100 oxygen atoms, I get 0.200 AMUs for that O18. That will give me that contribution. 17.999 times 0.2 divided by 100, 0.035998 AMUs. This one likewise has 3 sig figs. It was 5 to start, 3 in the percentage. I get to keep 1, 2, 3. I get to keep to that position there. I will now sum these, add them all up. And as I add them all up, I will round, it looks like, to the thousandths position. So we've got 15.95693.19 plus 0.0064596.62 plus 0.035998. That comes up to 15.999389.52 AMUs. And I said that I was rounding that based on this value to the thousandths position. And so my average for oxygen equals 15.999 AMUs for an average oxygen atom. And that is the value that when we look on the periodic table and we see what number comes underneath oxygen, which is element number 8. The value underneath it is 15.999. And that is the average mass for an oxygen atom. Okay, Eric, you asked, oxygen is hetero or homogeneous. When we look at an element, the elements do not fall under homogeneous or heterogeneous. homogeneous and heterogeneous were really used for mixtures. And what we're looking at here is an element, essentially. And that element is all uniform. I guess we could use the word homogeneous, but it's really being misused in that it really describes a mixture as opposed to a pure substance. And these elements are pure substances, even though they are made up of combinations of isotopes. So I want to be careful about that term, homogeneous and heterogeneous. Thousandths position, something with a decimal place. The thousandths position, the reason that I went through and did that was based on looking at the sig figs and going through and counting out five sig figs for the first one. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That was my last place. We had 3 and 3 based on the percentages that were given to us for these last ones. So it was 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3. And the positions, when I look at those decimal positions, the one with the most error, the one that has the most up and down, is the one in the thousandths position. And so that's where I do the rounding. Okay, Leah, are those different types of oxygen ever in the same atom? No. That isotopes, an atom is essentially, when we look at the atom and we look at oxygen 16, so if I look at oxygen 16 versus oxygen 17 versus oxygen 18, what are these really telling me? This is an atom that has a nucleus, and in that nucleus, I have 8 protons and 8 neutrons, and there are 8 electrons that are in the cloud. When I look at oxygen 17, oxygen 17 has 8 electrons in its cloud, but its nucleus has 8 protons and 9 neutrons. And oxygen 18, in the cloud, there are 8 electrons, and in its nucleus, there are 8 protons and 10 neutrons. And it is the number of protons which is determining that these are oxygens, but the number of neutrons can vary. And so they can't be in the same oxygen, having an isotope in the same oxygen. An isotope is really an individual atom in and of itself. So these are individual atoms. These equal individual atoms.
So is this the actual atomic mass that we'd see on the periodic table if we looked at oxygen?
Yes, it is. In fact, if we go back to a periodic table that I was using from this morning, and we look at the periodic table and we zoom in on oxygen, this has been rounded to 4 sig figs instead of 5. If we had a periodic table that had 5 sig figs, we would see it written as 15.999. So yes, that is correct. Let me see other questions. Marisol, could we get the smaller percentage values in decimals too for reference in future calculations? You can always take the percentage and write it as a decimal form. All you need to do is divide by 100. So Marisol, when we take and we look at the percentages, what we're doing, for instance, if I were looking at 99.762%, then the answer to your question is that 99.762% in decimal form equals 0.99762 in decimal form. And essentially what that is 99.762 divided by 100. And that's how we get it into decimal form, which is why I was dividing by 100, which answers somebody else's questions. Alex, why did we divide by 100 atoms? Because we were putting it into decimal form so that we could do the calculation. And also because we didn't want to calculate out for 100 atoms. When you take a percentage, what does a percentage really mean? This is a good question. What is percentage actually mean? How do we calculate percentage? These are excellent questions that need to be addressed, that address the reason for using 100. So what does percent mean? Percent means part divided by whole times 100. This is the meaning of percent. It is a value that tells us the percentage of the part divided by the whole, and we put it into percent, meaning out of 100. It is one part per 100 is what percentage actually means. So this is how we calculate it. And so basically what we would say is that when we measure the part, which is oxygen 16, out of the whole, this is the entire sample, whatever the entire sample is, and we multiply by 100, this would equal 99.762. And so what we do is we measure the mass of the oxygen 16 over the mass of the whole sample, divide them, or in this terms, we're actually doing a count. So we're looking at how many oxygen 16s, atoms, are found when we measure a whole sample out of the total number of oxygen atoms measured or counted, and then we multiply that by 100. And that is what equals our 99.762%. Interestingly, when we think about percent, percent is a type of concentration. So there is percent, there are parts per, which is really equal to a part per 100. I'll write that out in words.
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
If you scroll up to what you were just doing, what would we put then for total number of oxygen atoms measured?
Well, that depends. If we measure, let's say that we measure, let's do it this way.
For this example that we just did, would it be?
Right. See, that's the thing is that I can't tell you for this example that we just did because that doesn't relate to this example that we just did. This would be an experiment that was done before we did what we just did. And that is the number that is giving rise to the 99.762. That is a number that some scientists measured. Let's say that a scientist goes through and they measure some astronomically large number of oxygen atoms. Let's say that they measure 8.976 times 10 to the 26th oxygen atoms. And give me one second, 8.976. And out of all of those oxygen atoms, what they found was they found that 8.95, I need 3 6 figs, 5 times 10 to the 26th were actually oxygen 16 atoms. Then when they multiply this by 100, this is going to equal the 99.762%, meaning that out of all the oxygen atoms that we measured, 99.762 of them were oxygen 16s. And this would have been an experiment that was done previous to our measurement where we were calculating what an average is. And this is where the percentages come from. So what they do is they take large samples of these elements, run them through the mass spectrometer, and they calculate for the given amount of atoms that they inject, how many are each of the different isotopes. And then they calculate that into a percentage and that's what gets published. And then those are used to calculate the weighted average for an average oxygen atom. I'm sensing stunned silence. No, I'm getting a thumbs up. Okay. It wasn't stunned silence from you, Megan. I was sensing stunned silence from the class. Everything was just really, really quiet there. But everybody's understanding that, that's what that meaning is? Is that cool?
Yeah, just don't ask us to do it.
Right. No. But I am going to ask you to calculate the weighted averages for a sample. So I am going to give you the percentages and ask you to calculate out a weighted average for an element. So that is going to happen. But I wanted to finish another idea here where I was doing part per hundred. That part per hundred, this idea or concept of part per hundred, and what that means is, that means that I'm going to take and multiply, I take the part, divide by the whole, and multiply by 100, and that's what part per 100 means. And so we can think of that as PPH, part per 100. Ever hear of part per 1,000? Part per 1,000. Is equal to the part divided by the whole times 1,000. Part per million this equals the part divided by the whole times 1 million times 10 to the sixth. And so these percentages, or parts per 1,000, parts per million, or parts per billion, PPB, parts per billion, these are ways of measuring things that are very, very tiny, and we basically switch to whatever sort of measurement we need. These are measurements of concentration. Concentration is the ability to measure the part out of the whole. And we multiply it by a different multiplier depending upon how small it is. If the part per whole is fairly big, then we can use part per hundred, which is percent, and we give that term percent. The others are other types of percents, percent per thousand, percent per million, percent per billion. And they are all used exactly in the same sort of way, but to measure increasingly smaller amounts of material. So that allowed me to introduce that as well. You know what? It's 11:10. I'm sensing a break might be a good time here. Is this a good spot for a break?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I can take any questions. If you guys have any questions real quick, I'm happy to answer any questions real quick and then jump to a break. Just if anything came up, I don't want to just stop and leave you guys hanging. But if there aren't any questions, then I propose a 10-minute break and we'll come back and we'll do some more.
And you could just scroll up to the weighted average part because I want to make sure I understand that.
All the way up to here.
Okay, so it's just the percentage over 100 to make it into a decimal, and then you just multiply it by the weight of that type of atom.
Yep.
That isotope. All right, cool. That makes total sense.
Spot on. That's what you do.
Very cool graphic above that, though. Very colorful.
That's the benefit of being online. When I do this in the classroom, I use color as well in the classroom and try to bring as much color into it as I do here. This just makes it a little bit easier to do in an online format in this way.
Do you record your lectures in person classes as well?
Generally not. Generally, we just have those live, and unless a student wants to record them, I don't generally set up a recording. That would require sort of a video camera that's set back far enough to be able to capture the whole screen.
So this does, probably, yeah.
Yeah, and a microphone. And so this has some added benefits. With the microphone, it's hard because as you're walking back and forth across a wide board, the microphone is going up and down in volume unless you're wearing the microphone. So I tend not to do that. But this does have the added benefit of having the recording, and you can go back and watch the recording as you desire, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, less of a production team to make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. It does require a bit of a production team of one, though, because I'm going through and I'm editing those videos and I'm taking out the intermission where we do the 10-minute breakout, and I'm usually chunking out the questions at the end where I'm not screen sharing anymore, and students sometimes are in the view or identified, and so trying to protect your individuality and not having that on the recording forever. I try to get some of that stuff out if I can.
Yeah, much appreciated.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I'm going to take a break too, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
By the way, what app do you use?
Hey, I'm here.
Sorry, what app do you use for your drawing on the screen?
I'm using Notability.
Notability.
Notability. I've tried a number of different apps, and the one that I have found the most success with is Notability. It gives me the quickest switching back and forth between colors and pens, and it has some nice ability to be able to draw shapes and have those shapes snap into regular shapes, such that if I'm drawing a circle and I hold it for a second, it'll take my rough circle and will make it into a perfect circle. Or if I draw a rough square and hold it for a second, it'll pop it into a perfect square. And so there's some nice drawing capabilities that just make it really easy to take notes. Plus, it's super easy to grab an image and to move it or copy it or paste it or change its size and do all of those things. And I find that not only is it great for on-the-fly note-taking, for me in a presentation mode, it's fantastic for taking notes in a dynamic way as a student sitting in a classroom. It's the app that I would recommend the most in terms of accessibility of notes. And another really great feature is that as long as your handwriting is fairly legible, it can convert your handwritten notes into actual editable text. And so there's a convert to text mode, and it will take all your handwriting and convert it into text as well.
That's incredible. Yeah, the reason I was asking this is because my parents are teachers and they were trying to figure out like one of those apps to use. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, Notability. Notability on an iPad with a stylus is one of the best things. And in fact, I've been using it for a couple of years now with my kids, which is why I can draw the way that I do with it. Some of the illustrations that I do for lab and stuff, it's just because I've had a lot of practice playing with it. But all the other instructors in chemistry at Cabrillo were struggling when we first went into pandemic mode and online mode. And I was able to show them Notability. They've all switched to Notability. And some of them have even gone out and bought their own iPads just because of the ability to be able to do lecture like this. They were basically using a whiteboard app and writing with a mouse, and it was looking horrible. They couldn't do anything.
So
an iPad, a stylus, and Notability.
Yeah, so
can I jump in? I use Notability, and I was actually gonna recommend to the other students that they should, if they have an iPad, definitely download the app because it's so helpful for online learning.
Yeah. Thank you, Megan. It is. It is very easy to take notes. It's very easy to move things around. Or if you start in one place and you don't have enough space and you want to move things over, it's easy enough to move things over, to switch colors, to highlight things, all of that. Notability is fantastic for that.
They actually have a version now where you can download it right onto your Mac, which is helpful for like moving files around and getting things organized. But it doesn't have the feature where you can actually write on in the screen with the iPad pen. But you can do it allows you to do other features, and it's connected to your iPad, so it's really helpful.
Interesting. I didn't know that. So that's very helpful to me too. I move the files around just using what is it? It's AirDrop to be able to just to be able to drop the files back and forth between the computer and the iPad. And that has been a godsend, because in the middle of a presentation, I can go and grab things off the computer and just airdrop them onto the iPad quickly. And that works out. And this ability to have dual presentation mode, I have the computer, which is running the Zoom. Also, the iPad is then logged into the Zoom. And then I use the iPad to screen share and the computer to be able to monitor everything else. And it works out pretty darn well.
That sounds amazing. Carrie, and you were the one talking about like the taking notes with it, right? Is it easy to like organize your notes and like format them really well?
Yeah, if you're organizing them, I think what Megan is mentioning on the computer would be great. What I do within mine, so I'm bringing back up the screen share, is that in Notability itself, when I go out of Notability, you can create folders essentially for your various files that you want to create.
Oh, wow.
When you're within the folder and you create a new file, that file is created within that folder. You can
like the Notes app.
Yeah. And you can drag and drop them between the folders. So if you want to move something from one folder to another, you can do that. They have, when you're within a note itself and you want to switch really quick between notes, there's a way to just be able to slide out on the iPad, and I can switch between recently used notes, so I can go back and forth really quick between notes. There's all sorts of little built-in features, which is really nice.
You can import images, it looks like.
What's that?
You can import images, it looks like.
Absolutely, yeah. So that when you're in an image, you can definitely import. There are ways to bring in, you can change the paper style. You can export very easily to email or to Dropbox or to any of those different ways. You can print very easily from it.
Easy to send PDFs to submit files on Canvas through PDF.
Absolutely.
Megan, oh, that's really nice.
That's super nice. Yeah. And it also allows me to send notes to you guys so that I can email a note really quick. You can copy and paste any particular page or any part of a page and paste it right into an email such that I can communicate fairly quickly. When you guys have questions on email, I can just send you a note that I've created rather than trying to format something in an email or explain it in an email. I can do it visually from the iPad and get it to you guys that way too.
That's amazing. I have to look into that then.
Yeah. So it's really helpful. Super helpful. All right, I forgot what time we were supposed to come back. I think I did it at close to 11:20. We were supposed to come back.
Sorry, we used up your break talking.
You
about...
used up my break.
Yeah, I feel guilty.
Don't feel guilty. No, I'm good.
Thank you for the information, though. I'm gonna definitely like see about this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll just keep people a second. Is it time for break? Roxanne, we had break. Break is over. We were just chatting during break. Yeah, I know. Usually I put the music on and then you guys know that it's break and the music is over and you know to come back. What I would say is if you need a break real quick, go grab one quick. Go run, grab a drink of water. Run to the restroom if you need to. Jump back in. And I'll pick it up here in a minute. All right, I gotta think about what I wanna do next. All right. It is now 11:21. I'm going to kind of kick it back in again. We'll start up here. This is going to make it tricky editing for me later on this afternoon. Usually when I put the music on, it's really easy to find that break and find the music. And it shows up really clearly when editing a video. And then I can chunk out the music and we chunk out the intermission. But that's my problem for later. All right. What we did is we calculated out or showed how to calculate out the average mass of an element. And I'm going to go back to carbon for a minute. And we're going to look at carbon. And carbon on the periodic table, when we look at it, carbon being element number 6 on the periodic table, has a mass of 12.0114 atomic mass units. So what this means is the average atomic mass equals 12.0114 atomic mass units. But an atomic mass unit is not in and of itself very helpful. An atomic mass unit, because it's not in grams, and we don't measure things in terms of atomic mass units. We measure things in terms of grams. And so what we had was a conversion factor that said that one atomic mass unit was equal to 1.6605 times 10 to the minus 24th grams. And that's sort of a challenging number to memorize and a challenging number to have to use. And so what I propose to do is to introduce in chapter 2.4. So we sort of jump to 2.4 here. We have the introduction of the mole. And they put the introduction of the mole at the very end. And maybe I should just leave it there and we should deal with some of these molecular shapes. No, I'm already there. I'm going to do it. Let's talk about the mole. So this is chapter, we will introduce now, chapter 2.4. I'm going to go a little out of sequence. We're going to look at the mole. The mole is a unit. It's a unit similar to a dozen. When we think about a dozen, we know what a dozen means, that one dozen of anything equals 12 of that thing. So you can have a dozen of different things, and we can say one dozen eggs, and that equals 12 eggs. We could say that we have one dozen, I don't know, rocks, and that equals 12 rocks. That the unit of a dozen is an enumeration or a quantity of something. And a mole is similar, but the mole is just a much bigger number. One mole equals 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And it is just a value. And it is a value of any component. So we could take and we could say that I have one mole of eggs in the same way that I did dozens. And if I have one mole of eggs, then I have a very, very large omelet, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd eggs. So where did this value of a mole come from? A mole, the definition of a mole, originally, this was the original definition, and then we will do the next definition. The original definition of a mole.
Hey, Jason, I'm sorry. Can you scroll up just for 1 second? I got kicked out. I just want to take a picture.
There you go.
Is this where you started after the break?
This is where I started.
Thanks, all set.
Okay. So the original definition of a mole was the number of atoms in exactly 12 grams of carbon 12. Carbon 12 is the isotope of carbon that has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. So carbon 12 has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. And it weighed 12 AMUs. And when I used 12 grams, I don't know how I got a 16 up there, carbon 12. When I look at 12 grams of carbon 12, the number of atoms that were in there when they measured it was 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And that's what we said was equal to one mole. Now, we take away those atoms. We measured it in terms of atoms. But the mole doesn't mean necessarily atoms. A mole can be a mole of anything. We can have a mole of eggs, a mole of rocks, a mole of shoes. A mole is a number that is just like a dozen. And I said this was the original definition. The original definition of a mole was the number of atoms in exactly 12 grams of carbon 12. Well, they've made a new definition of a mole. And the new definition of a mole is that it is exactly 6.022 14076 times 10 to the 23rd things. Whatever, how many things we want to say that is. And that this is an exact number and that this is a definition. That definition is a very big number, a lot of digits to remember. And so what we do is we truncate this and we take the mole and we truncate it to 6.022 and we use it to 4 sig figs. And we remember it as 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And so this is a number that I want you to commit to memory. This is a number that I'm going to ask you to memorize. Is there a mole button on calcs? No, there's no mole button on calcs. Actually, there is. Avogadro's number. It is called Avogadro's number. So the mole, that's another thing. I didn't actually think of that. The mole is referred to or is called Avogadro's number. And it is given the symbol N with a subscripted A. And so the N with a subscripted A is the symbol that we use for a mole. And on many scientific calculators, not the TI-30 series that I was recommending for you guys to get, but on a larger Texas Instrument graphing calculator, the mole is in the memory. They have it as the symbol, and you can find it underneath, I don't know where you find it underneath the constants menu that the mole is programmed into it. But no, on most of the scientific calculators, it's not in there. And so you need to memorize it, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. So 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And from there, understanding what a mole is, and that we have a mole of things, what we want to do is we want to look at another calculation. I want to ask how much a mole of carbon is going to weigh. And so I'm going to ask this question.
Can I ask a real quick question, sir?
Please.
So then would you use mole as the unit, or would you use NA as the unit?
We use mole as the unit. And so if I'm doing a mole of something, the symbol of NA is the symbol that we use for the mole. It's the symbol that we use for Avogadro's number. In practice, that symbol is very, very rarely used. We usually, if we have a mole of something, for instance, we say that we're going to have 1 mole of carbon. 1 mole of carbon. Then we would write just 1 mole. If we have 6.723 moles of oxygen, the unit of a mole, or we put the S after it to include moles, a mole is not a whole number. A mole is, let me use mole in a way like we use dozen. Let me show you how we use it. Let's say that we have examples of use. Let's say that I have 3.72 dozen eggs, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because eggs come in whole values, whole numbers, right? But I could say that I have 3.72 dozen eggs. And if I want to know how many eggs that is, I take 3.72 dozen and I multiply by a conversion factor that says for every one dozen, I get 12. And so this is 3.72 times 12. That's 44.64 eggs. And based on the value that I used here that had 3 sig figs in it, I would take and I would round my final value off to 3 sig figs as well, 44.6 eggs. In the same way, I would use a dozen. I would use a mole. So let's say that I have 3.72 mole of carbon atoms. How many carbon atoms do I actually have? I have 3.72 moles of carbon atoms times a conversion factor that says for every 1 mole of atoms, I have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd atoms. So that's going to give me 3.72 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd . That's going to give me 2.240184 times 10 to the 24th atoms. And just as I did before, I had 3 sig figs. This is a 4 sig fig value that I have memorized the value of a mole to, smallest being 3, so I round to 3. And this is going to be 2.24. This is really important. Don't forget the scientific notation. That the scientific notation, even though we're doing rounding, the scientific notation is still part of that. And James, like pi, similar to pi, but different, because Eric, I'll catch that question in a second. James, similar to pi, in that pi is a ratio and a value. The mole is a value, but we don't generally say that the pi is a count of something or a value of something. The pi is a ratio of circle, and we use pi in numerous types of calculations. But the mole is different in that it is a count of something, more like a dozen than it is like pi. Eric, to your question, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is the value of the mole. When I multiply this times 3.72, I get a value times 10 to the 24th. And so my end result is times 10 to the 24th rather than times 10 to the 23rd. So the value of the mole is to the 23rd, but the outcome may have a different exponent in it, either bigger or smaller than the 23rd, when I go through and do that. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Kerrigan.
So 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is a mole.
Is a mole.
But here we have a mole over a mole.
Ah, what I have is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is the number of things in a mole. A mole is the unit. So when I think about a dozen, right, a dozen means 12, in the same way that I did up here, I had one dozen written in the bottom and then the number of things in a dozen. I'm doing the same thing. One mole, the mole is a unit. The unit means 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd.
Whoa.
Trippy.
I have a quick question.
Megan.
So when to do that calculation, I did 3.72 times 6.022, which gave me 22.40184. And so I basically just ignore the 10 to the 23rd until the very end. And then to put it in scientific notation, move the decimal over. So it's 2.240184. And then add a 1 to the exponent.
That is one way to do it, Megan. There is another way to do it in your calculator. If you want to enter this in the calculator, a better way to go through and do it is 3.72 times 6.022, and then use the E or the EE key on your calculator, and then enter 23 and hit equals, and it will give you 2.240184 times 10 to the 24th.
I had a hard time figuring out the E key, but on my calculator, I can just like literally do 10, and then there's an exponent button, so I can enter the 23 that way. Let me see if I get the same answer doing it that way.
Sometimes there's a 10 to the X key, and that can sometimes be used as well. Most of the TIs, though, are going to have either the E or the EE key.
The YX key.
The YX key is different. The YX key is a different key. So the YX, when you use that and you take and you put in a value, you could do, I suppose, this is sketchy. I wouldn't do this. Times 10, hit the Y to the X, and then hit 23. Sometimes what this does, it gives you an extra power of 10 depending on the calculator, and can always have your value be off by a power of 10 or a factor of 10. That's why the EE or the E key is the best key to use, because it means times 10 to whatever comes in next.
Okay. I used I have a TI-30XA and I used the YX key and I got the right number.
Okay, that's perfect. If you use the YX key there and then you've got it. So there's a couple of different keys. You just want to make sure that however you're keying it in, that you're getting this value to this exponent. So experiment with your calculator for a second and see. The difference between the E and the EE key, Megan, is a difference of which calculator you have. Some calculators use an E. Some calculators use an EE. Mine has the EE key, but many of the smaller SIs or Texas Instrument calculators have just an E key rather than EE. So that's why I'm trying to say it's calculator dependent. You need to look at your calculator and figure out what key your calculator uses. This is the moment of the class that we call calculator chaos, where calculator chaos ensues as everybody tries to figure out which one works for them. Once we get it figured out, though, then we're good. We just need to get it all sorted out. Okay. And Eric, yes, you have A through F, which are variables, and the E is a variable, and then the separate EE key, and that's why many of the graphing calculators use EE to separate it from a variable that you can store in. However, the smaller TI-30 series don't have that memory ability of all the variables, and they just use the E key as opposed to the EE. It's just a difference in the way that they need to block it out. Okay. So we've introduced the mole. Let me introduce another aspect of the mole. Let's calculate, let's do a calculation. How many grams does 1 mole of carbon 12 weigh? So what we're going to do is we're going to go from a mole, and we're going to go from 1 mole. We're going to go from moles to the number of atoms. And then from atoms, we're going to go to AMUs. And after we go to AMUs, we're going to go to grams. And we're going to use the conversion factors of a mole. And we're going to use, so this is going to be the mole conversion factor. We are going to use the average atomic mass for that conversion factor. And then we're going to use the gram to AMU conversion factor to get us to grams. So those are the three equalities. So writing out those equalities, 1 mole equals 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd.
What does AMU mean again? Is that the average atomic mass?
It is the atomic mass unit. It was our definition of mass for things that are very, very tiny, like a proton or a neutron. So it is a measurement of mass like grams, but very, very tiny. So we've got that. The average atomic mass, 1 carbon atom equals, for carbon 12, equals exactly 12 AMUs. And the last part is that 1 gram is equal to, where did I write that? I need it back over here. So far away.
I'm surprised you don't have it memorized.
It's not a number that I memorize. and it's lost and I can't find it. And I didn't want to shuffle my papers again. I got it. No worries. It is 1 gram equals 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th AMUs. Nope, I did it backwards. 1 AMU equals that many grams. There we go. Okay, so those are all our conversion factors. So what we're going to take is we're going to take 1 mole. And we're going to say that this is an exact value. So I want to say I'm starting with an exact 1 mole. And this is of carbon 12. And going through that, for every 1 mole of carbon 12, that makes 6.022. times 10 to the 23rd carbon 12 atoms. For every 1 atom of carbon 12, it weighs exactly 12 AMUs by definition. It's how the AMU was defined. And every 1 AMU is equal to 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th grams. Before I even do the calculation, I'm saying that I'm starting with an exact value. The 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, this is 4 sig figs because I have rounded the value of a mole. The 12 AMUs per carbon 12 was a definition that's how the AMU was defined, was 1/12 of a carbon 12 atom. And so that's where that definition comes from. And this is a measured quantity with 5 sigfigs for the grams to AMUs. So that means that the smallest number that I'm going to have that is going to come out of this is going to be 4 sigfigs. And so I'm going to do this calculation, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd times 12 times 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th.
When you told us earlier, you said 1 AMU equals 1.6605. Does it matter that it's one off?
Oh, you are really sharp. It is one off because I didn't go back and I didn't look it back up. And I calculated out what it was supposed to be based on numbers that I did have memorized. And so I had a sig fig rounding error there, but I don't think it's going to make a difference in our calculation.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you for checking on that. So this comes out to 12 point, and it did come out a little bit differently. Let me see if times 10 to the 23rd times 12 times 1.06605 minus 24. And that didn't come out right at all. Interesting. I don't know what I'm doing wrong there, but this is coming out to 12.0015984 grams. And this value, if we round it to 4 sig figs, is coming out to 12.00 grams. Oh, and I know why it's coming out, because I did exactly carbon 12 and I did 12 AMUs. 12 grams of carbon 12 in 1 mole.
Do we still cancel all the units up above? And if so, is atom considered a unit in this equation?
It is. Atom is considered a unit in this case. So moles are canceling, atoms are canceling, AMUs are canceling, and I'm left with grams, and grams are in the numerator. Okay, one of the interesting things here that I want to look at is I want to look at carbon 12 for a second. We said that carbon 12 equals 12 AMUs. And 1 mole of carbon 12 equals 12.00 grams. These numbers, 12 AMUs and 12 grams, there it goes, that's what I was trying to have it snap in, they're the same. Which is curious. Let me show you one more example. Let's take and calculate out, instead of carbon 12, let's say how many grams does 1 mole of an average carbon weigh, rather than the carbon 12 isotope?
It's the little 6 at the, why do you have a 6 there?
Because that 6 is the number of protons. This was the nucleate symbol, where the nucleate symbol, we use the mass number, which is the sum of the protons plus the neutrons. And then this guy is just the number of protons itself. So I was using a nucleate symbol to describe the carbon 12. Okay, let's ask the question. how many grams of carbon are in 1 mole, exactly 1 mole, of average carbon? Meaning all the isotopes. So we're looking at all isotopes, which means that we're going to use the isotopic, the average mass of 12.0114 from the periodic table in AMUs. So the average carbon weighed 12.0114. When we looked at carbon on the periodic table, if we go and grab it from the periodic table, we see that carbon is listed as 6 and is listed as 12.0114, and that this was the average atomic mass, and that average atomic mass is 12.0114 atomic mass units. Okay, so we're going to go through the same calculation, and we're going to use a roadmap that is going to go from moles to atoms to AMUs to grams, and we're going to use the essential same conversion factors. We are just going to substitute in the atomic mass of 12.0114 AMUs. So here I have 1 mole of carbon, and this is an average carbon now, not an isotope. For every 1 mole of carbon, I get 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd carbon atoms. For every 1 carbon atom, and this is the average carbon atom, it is 12.0114 AMUs. And for every 1 AMU, it is 1.066 Oh, we've been using 06, so let's keep doing that, times 10 to the minus 24th grams.
Is it 1.066 or 1.66?
1.6606. You're right, my memory's failing. Okay, so let's do that calculation. That is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Times 12.0114 times 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th. This comes out to 12.01155 and a bunch of nines grams.
Sir, and could you write out how you entered that into the calculator?
Absolutely. I'm entering it in 6.022. I'm using my EE key, and then I'm entering 23. And then I'm hitting the multiplication, 12.0114. Then I'm hitting the multiplication, 1.6606 EE on my calculator. Then I'm using a key that is at the bottom of the numeric keypad that has a negative sign in parentheses rather than the actual negative sign, because a negative sign will throw an error. So this is a symbol that means change sign. And then I enter the 24 and then the equals key. That's the way. Yeah, that's the way I'm keying that in.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, Megan, go for it.
So above, it says the average mass of average carbon, or I think the average mass, 12.0114 you gave us, is the average mass of all the carbon isotopes, right?
That's right.
Okay, so then if we ended up with our answer, which 12.01155999, that's only very slightly tiny, a tiny bit more than the average mass of all the isotopes. And I'm a little surprised, because aren't we converting I guess I'm confused as to why there's not a bigger difference in that number.
I'm smiling, Megan, that you're noticing that those two numbers are the same, because that's what I want you to notice. That they are identical, and that these numbers at the bottom of the periodic table have two different units, two different meanings. And that what we are proving is that by going through and doing this calculation, and we've done it to four sig figs, so out to four sig figs, the numbers are identical. So this is equaling 12.01 grams for that 1 mole of average carbon. And when I look at the bottom of the periodic table, the value at the bottom of the periodic table has two different meanings, and that's what I was trying to prove to you, and that's what I wanted you to notice. And so you're noticing that, and you're confused, like, why aren't they more different? And the answer is they're not more different because they're identical. They're not more different because the number at the bottom of the periodic table has two different units and two different meanings. So when we look at the bottom of the periodic table, and you just hit the message so beautifully for me, that when I look at carbon and this value, 12.0114 and 6, that this value has two different meanings. It is both the average mass for a single carbon atom in AMUs. It is also the mass of 1 mole of carbon in grams. It is both the AMUs for a single atom, and when I have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd of those atoms, it is the mass in grams. So we say it is the grams per mole for that material as well. How is it that that number is identical for both things? Go back to the calculation, look at the calculation. Do this for me. Take this number, take 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, divide 1 by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. See what happens in your calculator. See what value you get. Take and do this. Just take and say 1 divided by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. What do you get?
Same thing.
You get 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th. You get the value in grams per 1 AMU, which means that this number right here and this number are reciprocals. And because of that, they cancel each other out, which means that this value here of a mole and this value in grams per AMU cancel each other out. And the only number left in the calculation is 1 times 12.0114. The mole, the value of the mole and the value of an AMU in grams are reciprocal values. And when you do the calculation, they completely cancel each other. And the only value left is the value of the AMUs, which means that the value of the AMU is also the value of grams for 1 mole of material. And that value at the bottom of the periodic table has two different units. So I have written it out in words, but in text, in math, what it means is it is the AMUs per atom, and it is also the grams per mole. And that value has both units, and we apply the units to it that we need to for whatever calculation it is that we need to do. That is the lesson of what we're getting out of today in terms of going through the mole. And Vanessa, is that the same for all elements? And yes, it is. This is the same for all elements. So when I look at a periodic table and I look at oxygen, for instance, oxygen element number 8 has the value of 15.9994. Hydrogen 1 has the value of 1.00794. Carbon 6 has the value of 12.0114. Nitrogen 7 has the mass of 14.00674, I think it is, remembering off the top of my head. I'm trying to remember these. I'm not actually looking at them. And so what these all are saying is that this is the number of AMUs for a single atom, but it is also the grams for 1 mole of that material. So that 1 oxygen atom equals 15.9994 AMUs. 1 mole of oxygen equals 15.9994 grams. And the same is true for each of these other materials, that the value at the bottom of the periodic table has 2 different meanings. And we use the meaning for whichever question it is that is being asked. We either use it as an AMU or we use it as grams per mole. I sort of got excited there and started writing fast and talking fast, letting you guys sort of catch up. So Eric, is there a scale here or how large AMU atom is in relation to your grams per mole? Ratio? Ratio AMUs to atom versus grams per mole, sort of. I don't usually think of it that way. I guess you could kind of phrase it that way, that the number of AMUs per atom is the same as a grams per mole. But that's because of the reciprocal value of the number of AMUs per gram versus versus a mole. And it doesn't really matter. I think that's why I don't think of it that way, in that it's not, it's an important relationship, but not a relationship that we ever use in that way. Other questions? Sort of letting you guys catch up mentally to where we are. So what this means is that I could ask you how many moles. So let's, in the couple of minutes that I've got left here, let's show another example of how we use this. So we have what we call the atomic mass and what we call the molar mass. The atomic mass, when we think about atomic mass, this is the AMUs per atom. But the molar mass is the grams per mole. And it's the same value, it's just a difference in the way that we use it. If I wanted to say how many AMUs
does that say versus mole mass or molar?
Molar, M-O-L-A-R. So M-O-L-A-R, molar mass. How many AMUs do do 10, I don't want to stick with carbon, let's do with hydrogen. Do 10 hydrogen atoms weigh? In this case, what I can do is I can go through and I can say, all right, I got 10 hydrogen atoms. Let's do it with its symbol. Let's use a capital H. 10 hydrogen atoms times, for every 1 atom of hydrogen, it is 1.00 794 AMUs. So this is going to equal 10.0794 AMUs. And I could then go through and I could calculate out how many grams that is if I wanted to. And it would be a very small number of grams. But I could ask the question, how many grams does 1.52 moles of hydrogen weigh? And I would use the same value, but now 1.52 moles hydrogen for every 1 mole of hydrogen, I get 1.00794 grams of hydrogen. So this is going to equal 1.52 times 1.00794. 1.532688 grams of hydrogen. However, this is now a measured value with sig figs. 3 sig figs, 6 sig figs. I need to round to 3. This would equal 1.53 grams of hydrogen.
Is the 1.00764 the atomic mass of hydrogen?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
In the other value, this was a counted value. And as such, it's exact. We had sig figs that were 6 in the atomic mass units, and we kept 6 in the answer, which is why I didn't round the answer. And why I rounded the bottom answer the way that I did. So the difference between them. So when I'm talking about individual atoms, I can use AMUs, but AMUs are not very practical because remember that even in a small sample, there are a huge number of atoms in even a small visible sample of a material. And because of that, we tend to use the grams more than we use the AMUs. In fact, once we leave this chapter, we never go back to AMUs. We only function in the gram domain using grams and moles. And so as soon as we introduce a mole, we never actually go back to AMUs and we never have to think about it in terms of its dual purpose. But we introduced it as AMUs, and because we introduced it that way, we needed to make this transition or find this way to make this transition into moles and how we use a mole. And that's what this transition was all about. It was introducing the mole and showing how we can use the AMU value to transition to a mole and what that means for the bottom of the periodic table and the value that is its molar mass. And that the molar mass is now a grams per mole value. And we can use that grams per mole, which is great. So here's the grams per mole molar mass. This molar mass in grams per mole is now a conversion factor for going back and forth between grams, which is mass, and moles, which is count. It's a way of going back and forth between the mass of a material and the count of a material. I'm trying to scroll back up for those people who were trying to see up above. Okay, so Eric, if we were to ask the same question as one but rewritten, how many grams of 10 hydrogen atoms or how many grams in 10? Yes. No, you would not get 10.0794 grams. Eric, that's a good question. And let me complete that question for you and show you. So your question, Eric, is a little bit different than what I just did. If I want to know how many grams does 10 atoms of carbon weigh, then what I would do is I would take the 10 atoms of carbon, multiply that for every one atom of carbon, it is 12.0114 AMUs. But then I have to use the AMU to gram conversion. For every one AMU, it is 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th grams. And so I'm going to get a really tiny number. Oh, hydrogen, right. Sorry, hydrogen. We could switch that. I can make that switch quickly. 1.00794 hydrogen, hydrogen, and hydrogen. So this is 10 times 1.00794 times 1.6606 times 10 to the minus 24th. It's going to be a very tiny number. 1.6737 times 10 to the minus 23rd. Grams, and I would need to round then to, it was an exact count. I'm at 6 sig figs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, I didn't quite get enough sig figs in there. I need to pull a couple more sig figs off my calculator. Maybe I need to go to 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This actually rounds to an 8. And so this
equals. What if that ever happens where we get an answer that doesn't have as many sig figs as we need?
Megan, that's a great question. And the answer is, let's say that you need 6 sig figs. And the answer that the calculator spits out is 0.32. And you need 6 sig figs. What you need to do is you need to realize, oh, I need to add additional zeros in order to get you to the 6 sig figs. That's how you do it. Okay. Yeah. So Eric, I think that answered your question. Next question, would we ever put it into English system measurements instead of SI system? Yes, absolutely. All of that is coming in the stoichiometry. Yes, we will go back and forth and use the three keys in order to interchange between SI system and English system. And yeah, I could definitely ask you how many pounds of carbon, or I could go from pounds of carbon to how many moles of carbon do I have, or even how many atoms of carbon do I have. All of that is possible, and all of that I will torture you with to no end, because that's what we do. That's what chemists do. We love to just find ways to torture you guys and to give you obscure units and take you back and forth and exercise your mental acuity and jumping back and forth between different units. That's what we're here to do, is to exercise you. And so just like we would put you through the paces in the gym, we're going to put you through those mental paces and have you just do all kinds of crazy calculations. Yes, that's what stoichiometry means. It means mental exercises, and we're going to do lots of those. Eric, there's got to be an update to Zoom somewhere where students can scroll to whatever section of teacher's notes they want. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice that you could just scroll back and forth yourself between the screen? It makes it hard, especially I don't have a whole lot of screen real estate here. I'm working with a fairly small screen, and if I write too small, then you guys can't read at home in terms of what I'm actually doing. So I apologize. I know that that's a challenge. Okay, we are at 12:16. I've got 4 minutes left. I want to open it up to questions, but right before I do, I just want to say the next lecture that we do, I'm going to give you a bunch of molecular representations. We'll talk about empirical formulas. We'll talk about isomers. We'll go through that. And then we'll jump into these calculations and go back and forth between mass and moles and molar computations. I just want to do some of the molecular representations because I'm going to be drawing some molecules. And I want you to understand the drawings that I'm going to do that we are going to calculate out the molar mass from. So I've introduced molar mass and sort of this idea of molar mass. We'll jump back into some molecular drawings, and I'll show you some illustrations and different ways of representing molecules. And then we'll jump back into calculations, and we'll go from there, and we'll get lots of practice. And I also have two other announcements. I should have put them at the beginning of the notes rather than at the end of the notes. Two other announcements. I have a new homework set that I will put up tonight. I'll put that up on Canvas, and that will be for chapter 2. That is going to be the homework set that is the advised homework set for practice. I have a new quiz up for you guys on Canvas. That quiz is a dimensional analysis quiz. I think I had a due date on it for, did I put Wednesday night? I think I put Wednesday night. Was the due date. Although it's not a closed due date. So the chapter two homework, this is suggested. I'm gonna do another set in Canvas that is a smaller set in Canvas that will actually be graded. And I'll have that, I'll set a due date on that as soon as I put that up. I'm gonna try and put that up tonight too. So this is suggested, heavily suggested, like mandatory suggested, like if you don't do it, you're going down in flames and I can't help you if you don't do it. So that one doesn't get turned in, but I'll put up another one on Canvas and then I'll set a due date on that. The thing is, you can work ahead, but this homework set, a lot of these are the stoichiometry questions that happen in section 2.4. And my concern was that if I didn't lecture on them or give you enough to do it, that you were gonna get frustrated, which is why I hadn't put it up just yet. So that's a suggested one. The answers to the suggested problems, I'm trying to do two things. I am trying to add in many of those that have the answers in the back of the book. And then I forgot, or didn't really forget, it's just been super busy trying to keep up with you guys, that I need to do an answer key and put up a worked up answer key. That worked out answer key will go up on chemed.study because that's the easiest place to put it. And I will link it to the Canvas stuff so that I will give links, and I will send out an email also showing you guys where that is.
That's so awesome. Thank you.
So trying to keep all of that together. Vanessa, I think the question was, does that mean that chapter one suggested homework is mandatory also? Mandatory in that if you don't do it, you're not getting the practice that you need to get. Unless you feel comfortable that you can just walk in and do the assignments that I'm putting up on Canvas. But if you're struggling with that, the practice is really the practice from the textbook. That's where you're getting the majority of your practice. So mandatory versus suggested. Here's what I do with my Chem 12 students. This works really well with Chem 12 students. I tell Chem 12 students that every problem in the book is a good problem and that I cannot give you a subset because a subset doesn't make sense. Do all the problems until you feel that you can look at a problem and know how to solve it. And when you look at a problem and you know how to solve it, you've done enough of that type of problem. That's the type of practice that you need to do. So I am trying to give you a subset of problems that I think are really important because I think that this book technically does have a lot of problems that I don't like. They have problems that I'm not going to test you on. They have problems that deal with names and dates and certain experiments. And I'm trying to limit the amount of memorization that you need to do and the amount that I'm going to test you on. And so I'm picking out problems that are more akin to the types of things that I'm going to ask you in quizzes and other types of questions. So what I would say is out of that set that I am suggesting, do problems in that set until such time as you can look at a problem and know how to solve it. When you look at a problem and you know what you need to do to solve it, you've done enough of that type of problem in order to be successful at them. So when I say mandatory to do an entire homework set like that, what I mean is do enough of them until you feel comfortable. And then you can quit. How does that sound?
And the recommended problem sets on Canvas?
Yeah, although I haven't put the homework set up for number 2 on Canvas. I'll put that up tonight.
All right, awesome.
Yep. Okay, I think that's it for my announcements. How about any other questions?
Are we going to have open due dates for all of our assignments?
You know, it's working for me right now.
It's working for me.
Good. Okay. I don't feel a necessity. As long as you guys are staying up with it and people aren't falling too far behind, then I feel okay with that. That gives flexibility to those people who are working in an asynchronous mode. And so that I feel like I'm supporting everybody in that way. So I'll continue to put the due dates on things. However, it'll be a loose due date. There's flexibility in that due date. So I'm not going to put a termination date on it. But try not to work too far behind, because in a 6-week class, if you fall behind, it's very, very challenging to catch up.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else from anybody? Okay, if that's it, I suggest that we adjourn, take a break for lunch before we come back for the afternoon lab and catch those people in the afternoon lab.
Thank you.
You're welcome, guys. Take care. Have a good day.
Hey, Jason, I don't know if you mentioned this, but when's the first exam going to be?
I was wondering who was going to ask that. Megan, my original proposal had the first exam at the end of 2 weeks, and then a second exam at the end of the next 2 weeks, and a final at the end of the class at 6 weeks. So I broke it up into 2-week chunks. I still anticipate following through on that, but what I was going to do was take and post the exam for like the weekend and then leave it with a similarly sort of open date. And it's unlimited time. So I didn't feel a whole lot of pressure for the exam in the same way that I would feel a pressure for an exam in an in-class timed exam, which is why I didn't get too into freaking you guys out with an exam showing up. So sometime this weekend.
And the exam will only have one attempt, correct?
No, I think that, the multiple attempts is working for me as well. So I think that similar to a quiz, I'll throw 2 attempts at the exam.
Would you be open to creating, or maybe you already do this, but creating like a study guide or like a practice exam, because I just feel like there's so much material, so just to kind of narrow down what we really need to focus on.
I think that that's what, creating a study guide for it, and the study guides that I've done in the past have been more an enumeration of the different materials in each of the chapters rather than a fleshing out in full examples, because the notes that I'm doing, if I were to sit and make a study guide, it would be essentially the entire notes showing you examples and how to do things. It's the important topics that I think that I can hit to give you a study guide of things to go over or particular problems to practice. As a practice test, I think that I'm going to try to get away from giving you a practice test in that we're not going to have the same pressure that we would have in a normal class sense. A practice test makes sense to me when we walk into a class and a classroom and we have an hour and a half in order to do that test in, and that test is going to happen on Thursday, and you get one attempt at it, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure on that.
I just remembered you said too that we get 2 attempts. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah. And in that too, you can also go into it and you can preview the test and you can leave the test midway. And so you could actually go through and look at the test and go and work on problems and then come back and input those problems. So the test doesn't have a time limit on it. So I think that you could even look at the test and you're going to see it ahead of time before you even have to put an answer in.
Okay. That's amazing. Thank you.
Okay. So the pressure is off. I think that I'm sensing anxiety in the normal classroom mode sense that we would have anxiety in that. And I'm trying to alleviate all that anxiety.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else from anybody? Okay. I'm going to end the session then because I'm going to go grab lunch. That gives me a half an hour to go eat real quick. And I suggest that those of you in the afternoon section go and do the same. All right. So get up, get some exercise, stomp around a bit. We've been sitting in chairs for a long time. And I'll see you guys in the afternoon session, or those people who I won't see in the afternoon, I'll see you tomorrow. All right. Take care, everybody. And I'm going to go ahead and end the session from here. All right. Bye-bye.